A further point to do with singing and phrasing, expressive slides is raised with both Herman Marton and Herbert Brodkin.
Well, that brings me to something that I could never understand. But you know, he's a Viennese, and you know Strauss and all that, and they use a lot of that in, yes, in their music. And his fourth symphony, his theme is da 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 ti da. My God, he asked all the first violins to do da 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 do. That. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. He insisted on certain slides in his music. In his music. Whereas sometimes in a slow movement in other composers, he would do that too. For instance, he said you couldn't go da, nobody sings like that. So you have to slide to get there. Da, he would sing that for you that way. Well, how else would you play it?
How could you characterize his sense of tempo? Were there wide tempo variations? Was it unyielding? Was it?
That is very important. Flexibility. Mm-hmm. And that's what Mahler had.
Uh-huh.
You know, those things, that's a study in itself. He practices what Wagner preached, the tempo. He followed it according to the understanding. After you take note of the initial marking, then you must do your part.
Would you say that the tempo variations were wide that Mahler indulged in, or were they small?
Oh, just a shade. But it's the difference between freedom and slavery.
Uh-huh.
A shade.
They say that no two bars were the same tempo in
Mahler. But there you are. Mm-hmm. And yet it was the same. Mm-hmm. Of course it was the same. When you got out at the end of the second or first bar, it was just there. So it's a certain freedom that you think, well, this is not going to go together anymore because too much. But it catches up and comes up. It just quivers within it, but keeps in the tempo.
Uh-huh.
No matter where it is and what it is. It's what the composer demands, what his composition demands.
Now that we have some picture at what Mahler was driving at regarding general musical approaches, we'll turn to something touched on but not thoroughly brought out yet, Mahler's habit of reorchestrating other composers' music. We'll hear it discussed by both Herman Marton and Benjamin Cohen.
Musically, he did, I would say, the most surprising things in the world. Now, for instance, Till Eulenspiegel. At the end of it, you know, the D clarinet, that funny-sounding high clarinet,
mm-hmm,
when he's hanged, has a cadenza to go way up. And my God, Mahler says, no, we don't want D clarinet. We want a plain clarinet. Yes. He was kind of very arbitrary and wasn't very particular.
I recall that. I think we were doing Don Juan, and he added some bells or something like that. He added just a few notes somewhere. He says, you see, when Strauss wrote this, he was a young man. Now, he says, in Salome, he would orchestrate differently, he says.
Now, take in Beethoven's symphony, he had the E-flat clarinets in there, such a half-sharp instrument. And he had that, he put that in the Beethoven. Oh, my God.
This is in the last movement of Beethoven's Eroica. Tam, 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 tam. Now, he added an E-flat clarinet to that to give it a shrill sound. He said that was a Hungarian tune and it should sound like gypsy-like.
He was reckless in that respect. He just did what he thought it should be, not what it was.
Of course, he was the first one in this country, I think, who wanted double woodwinds.
For Beethoven or
even Brahms or certain compositions where he wanted the woodwinds to come through because, you know, in the old days they had such a small wind section.
Now we move on to Random Recollections by Benjamin Cohen. We went through the old New York Philharmonic programs together, and to Mr. Cohen, time and again, a little flash of memory would come through. Something to do with a Mahler performance, an anecdote, or something about a specific musical point to do with a specific work and the way Mahler played it. Here are some of those random reminiscences.
One thing, he played the Espana Rhapsody. He played it more than once. And I know there's one section there where the bassoons play in unison with one another.
Well, we had four bassoons playing that passage. I think it's written for four, if I'm not mistaken. And he said, gentlemen, this composition is the foundation of modern music. He considered the Espana as the foundation for modern music. And then we played the Nuage, Clouds. He used to say, that must be played like a mist. He says, gentlemen, don't misunderstand me. He says, I don't mean garbage. Mist in German means garbage. He says, because anything I say goes to the press, he says. He did the Tannhäuser Overture in the Bacchanal. Oh, he did that marvelously, that Bacchanal especially. He certainly went to town. The orchestra blasting away there in those climaxes. One critic said we were watching the roof, see if the roof would be blown off.
Mahler played some of his own works in New York.
Yeah.
Do you recall any moments during Mahler's conducting of his Fourth Symphony, for example?
Well, he was... He was very modest about it, didn't bother us much. We practically played through the whole work, with little corrections, little stops here and there. He'd give more time to other things than he did to his own compositions.
His pastoral was on this program, the Pastoral mm-hmm. Symphony. I think
yes.
It was one that meant a lot to him. He had a special way, I believe, with the second movement.
Well, I remember in the second movement, you know, those Boyd calls toward the end of the second call. He says, oh, this is... what was a nightingale and some other bird. He says that it must sound like this. He tried to whistle between his teeth and it sounded very funny. And the flute player we had that time was an Italian. He says, I know in Italy they eat these birds. He had a pretty good stentorian voice. You wouldn't think it coming out of a little man like he was. And, when he'd get into a rage, he'd scream. You could hear him three blocks away. He gave everything, even his voice, his shouts, his actions. But another thing is, he wasn't crazy about American music either.
Did he play any?
Yes, we played Leffler, something that isn't played anymore, and McDowell's music. So he whispered to the concertmaster, he says, "Das ist Buttermilch music. Buttermilch music."
Both Benjamin Cohen and Herbert Borodkin recall Mahler's rather strong feelings about Tchaikovsky as a symphonic composer.
He didn't like Russian music, and particularly Tchaikovsky. He says, "You see, Tchaikovsky was a very talented composer. He had beautiful melodies, but they were really Italian melodies," he says, "on the Italian style. Nice music, but he says it's not symphonic."
What was the audience reaction like to Mahler as conductor? Did they seem to take to him?
Not too much. Mm-hmm. Well, in those days, they weren't accustomed. Richard Strauss was very strange. Mm-hmm. They thought that was music that shouldn't be played. And Mahler's, of course, was a little bit more far-fetched than they had been accustomed to. And they didn't quite get it.
The hall wasn't well-filled.
Not very well-filled, no.
He said that the audiences, you know, when he conducts Mozart or some of the classic composers, he says, "I don't understand these American audiences." He says, "We perform it well. I give my best." He says, "They just sit there and dream about something."
By now, the scene has been well set, and you're familiar with the characters and their voices. We'll let Herman Marton, Benjamin Cohen, Herbert Borodkin, Nathan Liebenbaum, and Victor Fuchs carry on from here with the additional help of Anna Mahler. And I'll step, if I may, into the frame with them. And we'll let this scrapbook turn its own remaining pages.
He made short rehearsals. Physically, he couldn't stand them. And he used to make a remark in German. He'd say, after the rehearsal, he said, "Alles hat eine Ende, bloß eine Wurst, die hat zwei." Everything has an end, except the worst. That has two.
He's always... His wife would come in sometimes to a rehearsal. If we would rehearse upstairs sometimes, we couldn't get the main hall. His wife and daughter would come in. Always looked at them, always smiled. He was always so happy to see them. Must have been a good relationship then. And she was a very gracious lady, Mrs. Marlowe.
What did she look like then?
Beautiful woman. Blonde. Rather tall. As I say, she looked... Reminded me of Madame Jiritsa.
What was most striking about her?
Her personality, you know. Spoke beautifully, you know. Charmingly. Very nice woman.
And she had her daughter Anna with her at that time.
She was a little girl that time, maybe 9 or 10 years old. Mm-hmm.
I remember him very well. I was nearly 7 when he died. But my memories are not anecdotes. Are nothing to say. They are that I remember his voice. I remember his hands. I remember his walk. His very strange walk. I know exactly what it was because I walked with him. People say it was a nervous tick. It wasn't. It was irregular, but it was a change of pace. Every few paces, he just changed.
He shifted gears.
He shifted, yes. That was all. Why did it? I don't know. It was somehow nervous, apparently, but it was not a tick. It was not, you know, it just shifted. I walked with him as a child often, so I know these things. And I remember these terrible lunches, you know. I wasn't allowed to speak, and he was always absorbed and thinking about other things, and we had dreadful food. Anyhow, it appeared to me so. But I do remember when he suddenly took notice of me, the complete change, and as if it were a burst of warmth. That I remember so well. It didn't happen often because he didn't have time, but suddenly he took notice of me. And the change in the face, these are my memories, you know? I know so much, but it is so strange that I really only recognize 2 or 3 photos. The others are cold to me and could be any, you know? And there suddenly, oh, that is the memory. It is so personal. Of course, it is always the pictures of the very last time when he was, my God, old. He was 50. But he was old in some way. He was so spent. He was really lined. It was a dramatic face in his last year.
And the pictures that you recognize are the ones that dramatized that particular period in his life.
And also this little smile. I mean, he had a most lovely smile. And so warm, but from this mask-like behavior, this sudden burst is maybe my main memory. I always sort of fiddled about and I had a pair of scissors and I cut into something. And then Mummy said, did you do that? I said, no, of course not. And I lied. And I was sitting in the sitting room in this lovely, and Marla came in and he knelt down and he said, well, don't you think that the scissors might have suddenly moved? And I said, yes.
And you couldn't do anything to stop him.
No, well, there, of course, I confessed, you know.
I knew there was another story.
Well, there you are. I mean, but this is not a story. I can see it in front of me. I know it. But these things can't be said.
It's funny that we played some concerts at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And he never took a cab into town or a... Or somebody had sent a limousine for him, like they did for something. Like he used to take the subway into town.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, as I was in the same car with him, and I just tipped my hat to him. And he looked at him. I don't think he recognized me. He had very poor eyesight, but he'd see things that you wouldn't think he saw. You know, sometimes way in the back
of the orchestra.
Yes. Uh-huh. He never could get enough volume out of us to play the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth. He always wanted more and more, like a cataclysm, a, I don't know, volcanic eruption. He wanted something that we really couldn't give him. And, well, one day, he finally got what he wanted. And he was really delighted, genuinely delighted. And he invited the entire orchestra to have a little after-concert snack with him.
Oh, very friendly to everybody, very nice, my God. He shook each hand with everybody and talked and listened and this and that. And
he never cared to speak of his experiences, though. Marlon never used to talk about his past.
He thanked us, and he hoped we'd all be together a long time, which, of course, didn't. He only conducted a year and a half. He had to go back to Europe, and then the concertmeister took over Spearing.
Do you recall Mahler's last conducting session, his last concert?
No, not exactly, because, of course, I don't remember anything, because we didn't know it was his last concert. He never showed up again.
He took ill and stayed away for, I don't know, maybe a week or so. Not even a week, because he came in a day or two before the concert he had to conduct. And he said, well, he said, of course, we are not really ready with this composition yet, but he says, I don't want to keep you gentlemen later, because on account of my sickness, I don't want you to suffer for it. And he didn't call for any overtime or anything, which he was entitled to if he wanted it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I think a week or so later, he took really ill, and that was the end of it. And he went back to Vienna.
What did he show it in his last concert?
No, he pulled himself together. He had that iron willpower.
Mahler was dying, let's say, 1910, 1911. I attribute Mahler's idiosyncrasies rather to his ill health.
I don't know whether now it was streptococcus, but it was something else, which I heard even now they would not have a remedy. And they brought him to Paris, where there should be some medicaments and more treatments for him. But it was without hope. So he wished to come. He has known that he will die. So he wished to come to Vienna. And they brought him to Vienna, but nobody has seen him. He came already as a half-dead man to Vienna.
I remember him still in Paris. He was in hospital in Paris, and I remember that I came to him in bed. They all traveled to Vienna, and I know by hearsay that I was called in to say goodbye to him. No memory. I do think that maybe for somebody quiet and dramatic, like I myself, dramatic things like saying goodbye didn't enter.
Were you at the funeral?
Yes, of course. It was very simple. Above all, it was not announced. It was very interesting because when the coffin went down, it was like it was staged by the heaven itself, you know? Because when it was buried, then a bird went up and the sun came out a little. That was a typical fall setting, you know? That was a very sad, because the whole circumstance and this longing for Mahler to die in Vienna, where they harmed him so much.
We didn't realize, though, in general, that he was such a sick man, no. So one must make allowance, really, I guess, in the last year, composing all the time. Do you realize that? You see what willpower he must have had.
Yes.
That he didn't show it.
You know, there was a big letdown in the Philharmonic after Mahler passed away. It was a big letdown for a year or two.
Personnel?
For 10 years.
It's funny, in the basses, there's somebody called Malik.
Malik, he died long ago. He was a fine bass player. I knew the family there. My goodness, you know, come to think of it, there's very few of us left. Now the rest are gone. I don't see anybody else here. Bocconi, all of them gone.
Isn't that strange?
They're all these people are gone now.